Ross, you and Erica work together on this one. And I'm just going to sit back, and if people come in and want to attend the meeting, I'll admit them. And Scott and Todd, I have the share screen set to all participants, so you two can choose when you want to share your screen.
Okay.
And I'm just going to sit back and monitor the recording and the teleconference.
Okay, one second. I need to grab my phone. Marla had sent me just some notes that I wanted just as far as kind of opening remarks, so give me one second.
Sure.
All right, so one thing that I think just before we get started here, and Erica, please jump in if you want to correct me or clarify something, but the purpose of tonight's meeting is to be informative and no specific actions will be taken. There will be a time for discussion among the commissioners. There's no public comment accounted for during this meeting. And that's really the reason why, if you've listened, Mike, I'm not sure if you listened to the city council meetings, but one of the things is, you know, we're not set up to recognize public comment. And because of that, this is just going to be an informative presentation. During the discussion, a reminder to all commissioners, please introduce yourself by name before your comments so that those participating via phone can follow along. That's all I got from this side, Erica.
Perfect.
Who will do roll call?
You or Erica?
Erica.
Sounds good. So starting with the chair, Ross Henry.
Present.
Tom Stevenson.
Present.
Michael.
Present.
Let the record show that Greg Hohensee has not logged in yet. And Seth to be excused on vacation. And do we need a motion to excuse Seth?
I make a motion to excuse Seth for vacation.
I second.
Thank you. So the first item on the agenda would be reviewing the minutes. Did everybody get a chance to review the updated draft minutes that were sent earlier this morning?
I have.
Yes, that was from our last meeting.
That's right.
Yes. Sorry. One clarification, Erica. Do we have a quorum without Greg and Seth?
Yes, there's three of you.
Okay.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing this.
Just wanted to clarify.
Perfect.
Just as a point of order, you couldn't vote on your motions if you didn't have a quorum, but if for some reason there was only two of you, you could continue with the presentation and discussion.
Thank you.
So if there's any comments, I can take them now. If not, you can make a no motion.
Before I make a motion, I'd like to ask Erica, I was one that sent in the request for clarification. It wasn't a correction. It was a request for clarification on that one point. Was I correct in doing that, or should I have just held that to this meeting?
No, that was best to email it in, and then I can go ahead and clarify. And so because I saw the point could be clarified further in the minutes, I went ahead and updated. So that was perfect. Thank you for doing so.
Thank you. I got a message from Pat about that, and I wasn't quite sure what he was getting at.
Yeah, is better if council members ahead of time or planning commission members have corrections. If those can be sent in ahead of time, it's always helpful. It makes the meetings run a little smoother, and then ideally the clerk or the associate planner in this case can then send those out back out ahead of time. And then that way you're not spending extra time discussing corrections.
That's exactly the point of my doing it.
And just as a point for the motions, it will be a roll call. So what will happen is somebody will move and second it. And then when Ross calls for the vote, then Erica will read each name and record the vote. And you'll vote aye or nay.
We will, but there's no action to be taken tonight, correct?
Approval of the meeting minutes.
Okay.
I move the minutes from the March 11th meeting be approved as correct, as amended.
Let's state your name.
Tom Stevenson, second.
Thank you. And so approved as amended. All in favor say aye, starting with Michael.
Aye.
Tom?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
And Greg and Seth are not here. Therefore approved. And the second item on the agenda, if there's no further discussion?
No.
Would be now the presentation. And I'll hand that over to Todd and Scott, please.
All right, I will try to share my screen. There we go. Everybody see this?
Yes.
Yes.
Can you make sure you talk loudly?
Okay.
We don't have a very good connection here.
Gotcha. Well, this is about a 10-slide presentation. So in my experience, as we have given these over Zoom type of formats, it's good to maybe have me kind of give you the entire presentation, and with Scott's help, get through that in about 10 minutes, and then go back to slides that you can flag with questions. And I'll just start by saying we appreciate the opportunity to talk with the Planning Commission tonight. This is a project that we started at the beginning of the year, kind of before COVID days. And, you know, thankfully, Jan was somehow able to provide comments during the course of the pandemic and help us get to this point. We've also received quite a bit of stakeholder input that Scott can summarize, which was also done in the January-February timeframe. So we had a lot of input kind of before everybody went into lockdown. And what we've done basically is a buildable land inventory. This project began with Klickitat County and the city agreeing to work together on a buildable land inventory. And that also included a countywide look at residential and employment land needs for the next 20 plus years. Scott Kyler and I did this work for you, the city of White Salmon, about 7 years ago. It's probably the last time we did this. And so it was nice to go back and look at those numbers and see how they compare to today. And the purpose of this work is really, in my view anyway, I'm sure others can add different perspectives, but to show some city-county coordination in your look at long-term land needs for employment and residential uses as a precursor to making local changes to your zoning code and your development code that might reflect findings that come out of projects like this urbanization study. It also shows other stakeholders like the Gorge Commission and other friends in the area and property owners that a significant level of stakeholder outreach has occurred in advance of making any land use policy decisions. So it's a, from our perspective, an important project. It sets the stage for policy changes you might be considering over the coming year or two that come out of the comp plan update. So we're going to talk about the findings. These are all draft findings. We are hopeful that the input we receive tonight will help us fine-tune our draft report and finalize that document for the purpose of this study. If you do have thoughts, share them tonight. If other planning commissioners have input over the coming week or two, I'm sure we'll get that input from you. And then our hope is that the schedule will include fine-tuning and revising these findings in the month of July, so we can pretty much button this up by August. The buildable lands inventory included an update to all the data, the shapefile information we could get from the city, the county, and other parties to, first of all, depict the current city boundary after a few annexations have occurred in the last few years, and then to analyze the land within that area by zoning or by comp plan designation to determine whether it's planned for residential or commercial or possibly a mix of uses. And then we also looked at topography and other types of constraints such as floodways to determine what land is likely to be underdeveloped or undevelopable. And also determine and classify land based on whether it was fully built out, partially built out, or vacant. And so we did that pretty much for the whole county. And then here we're showing City of White Salmon land with the steep slopes and the other wetlands or stream floodplain areas in blue, steep slopes in orange. And then you end up with a few pockets of yellow, which is the vacant, primarily the vacant land.
Todd, sorry.
Yes.
Todd, is it appropriate, as we have, how can we input our questions? Do you want us to have them as you go, or would it be best just to wait till the end as far as more or less clarifications to your presentation?
Yeah, let's see if we can spool them up, and then we'll come back to the three topics: the buildable land, the residential need, and the employment need, and then we'll come back to this. I'll try
Okay, so we'll have a break between, and then we can, I'm just taking notes here, and I just had, wanted to know when the right time was to pose those
questions. Let me stop at each section, okay?
Thank you.
Okay. So we found about 118 acres of vacant, part vacant, and redevelopable land in residential categories within the city boundary. There are a few large vacant developable properties. Some require infrastructure extensions that could be, of course, more costly, and that's probably why some of those sites haven't developed today. But there are locations, throughout the city, and, if that area was fully built out, probably could handle about 450 to 480 dwelling units. Is our estimate, give or take. And you'll see later as we project future demand for about 1,000 units over the next 20 to 30 years, that shows you that, the existing land supply should be sufficient for about 5 to 10 years. On the commercial land needs, we found about only 5 acres of buildable residential land in the employment categories with no really industrial zoned land in the city. The Riverfront District was where we found the remnants of some employment land, buildable employment land. Again, it's close to floodways, could be fairly expensive to build those sites, but technically they are considered to be buildable. There's also some redevelopable land that we could find in downtown, few 1 acre parcels, maybe less, that could over time be redeveloped for some higher, more intense uses. Within the urban exempt area, there's plenty of additional land. About 335 acres of vacant developable land has been identified. All of it in the very low density category. It's kind of a holding zone, if you will, before annexation to try to keep the land underdeveloped as long as possible before you serve it with infrastructure. There are a number of topography constraints in these areas, so certainly higher than average infrastructure costs, which would likely drive up housing prices if those areas were to develop. The employment land in the urban exempt area is also fairly limited. We found, again, about 8 acres of commercial employment land in white salmon, mostly in the areas north of the city boundary, and about 76 acres of industrial employment land in the Bingen area. Again, some of that's also constrained, close to floodways, streams, and that in the river. So probably be more expensive to build that land, but it is considered to be buildable over the next 20 years at some point in time. So that's pretty much what we found with the buildable land inventory. Yeah, I'll take a break for questions right now.
Thank you. Can you define what partially developed lands consists of, or is that just meaning that you have, say, can you explain that?
Yeah, partially developed is considered to be a site that has an existing building with some value. Typically the value is over $50,000 of improvement value. So, you know, typically it's a homestead on these sites, and you know, it could be a tear down or they could subdivide around it.
Got it. Is it possible in this study to get a location of throughout the urban exempt area where the utilities currently are? You had mentioned about the costs and understandably so, but is there a way that we can also, through this study, pinpoint where the utilities are as it relates to these vacant and partially developed lands?
I think I defer to Scott on that. He did some research on that. The purpose of this project wasn't really to identify exactly, you know, what infrastructure is available to serve these areas, but we did look into where infrastructure was stubbed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question, Commissioner Henry. The study wasn't to locate pipes for developable land or redevelopment sites, but to generally understand capacity within the master plan. And it is not true across Klickitat County, but it is true that generally the housing and employment land that's discussed in this particular study could be accommodated with the master plan infrastructure capacity, you know, with improvements for conveyance. The need for conveyance, particularly if we're talking about water and sewer, you know, the sewer is shared between white salmon and Bingen, but the real need in terms of conveyance and service comes up in the urban exempt area, but there are pockets on the fringe further out from the city proper that also need expansion. And then there's one area where we're sort of still without a master plan, or there's a draft stormwater master plan. So, you know, we took a look at generally transportation service, where do roads need to be extended, and the core capacity under the master plans for water and sewer. And so that's, you know, it's not site specific, but generalized in the study findings.
I guess my thought goes along as we're looking to see, you know, growth expansion and how it interacts with the urban exempt area. And maybe this can be a, you know, be provided at a later date, or maybe we already have it, but understanding within these areas where utilities, where city utilities are already in place, and in what spots may be deemed unfeasible, given topography, given, you know, if there's some of that 480 or 335 acres of vacant land that based off of, you know, which isn't critical. I mean, someone could still, you know, have their own septic.
So Ross, that is not within the scope of this project. And if the city wanted that done, it would cost us extra money. And due to COVID-19, I don't believe that money's available right now.
Jan, is that something that we have, that the city has as far as a mapping?
We do not have the capability to do the mapping overlay and stick it in this project. Certainly there are some maps that show where our water and sewer lines are, which, you know, certainly at some point they need to be updated, and it would be great to overlay them. But at this point, that's not part of this project. It's a project that could maybe happen later down the road, a separate mapping project where we take maybe maps from our urbanization study and then do an overlay with our water and sewer lines. We'd have to hire somebody. That likely would not happen in 2020. It's possible that it could happen in 2021 if the council thinks that that's a product that would be useful.
Thanks for that clarification.
Jumping ahead too, just real quick. I mean, one of the recommendations of this study so far, again, it's draft, open for input, is the need for about, you know, looking for about 80 to 100 acres of kind of the land that's probably most cost effective to serve with infrastructure outside the existing city limits. But that need, again, probably doesn't occur for probably at least 10 years. But that is one of the recommendations, and certainly want to look at where infrastructure stubbed, where you could get to collector roads, where services could be provided nearby, kind of access to schools. Number of criteria could be considered at that point.
That's the same thing I was thinking. I think that we're going to identify areas basically because we sort of know where there are utilities. And once they're identified, then you can go further at making it more accurate without trying to do an accurate overall study that is not that good in specific areas. I mean, it'd be better to focus.
Exactly.
And I think that this thought of expansion and identifying what kind of lands we want and where those lands are would be wise to do starting ASAP. Even though you say we have 5 or 10 years of land available, there's a lot of ifs on that. And one of those ifs is, do they want to sell their land or develop it? You have no control of that. So it's demand induced, it's not supply. if you understand what I mean. In other words, if just because we have land, you're not going to fill it necessarily. If someone comes and they want to do something, then that's where that's how the land gets done.
That's right. And it's typically it's going to require a property owner that wants to see it developed, willing to invest quite a bit of money, to extend the roads, sewer, water, and it has to be a big enough site typically to make it worthwhile. A lot of factors get considered at that point.
Well, there are some ideas out there, and all this is going to do is show that we need it, and we better start moving that direction.
Yeah. If I could, Commissioner Stevenson, and also Commissioner Henry, the point here I think that we need to make is the recommendations are for a 10-year plus land need, but just as you pointed out, that gives you opportunities, whether those are seeking grants or lining up budgets, to start to ferret out the serviceable properties that you'll need so that you don't get a gap between your 8 and 12 where you're trying to hurry up and study this and get going. So I would wholeheartedly agree that you've got some study findings that would support getting, using the next 5 years to get a start on this and understanding the infrastructure and next steps. We can't just go to a willing seller and afford to just leapfrog. We're going to have to find the best, most efficient kind of sub-area plan to service outside the city limits to make the dollars work.
Yeah. There's some new grant programs available from the state now to, especially if you're going to explore housing in some of those areas that might be more attainable to people at certain percentage of the area median income.
Todd, remember, we are a non-GMA planning county. And a lot of those grants are not, in fact, almost all of them are not available to us.
But you're seeking consideration for that at some level, at some point.
To become a GMA planning county?
It's been discussed.
Not at the county level, it hasn't.
I think you just start looking. I think we're going off in a direction here that's not part of this urbanization study.
That's correct.
So we'll talk about housing needs, because I think this drives some of your thinking about the type of zoning that might be required to meet the demand in some of the both the urban exempt area and potential annexations, but also within the city, because there's a changing demand profile of households that needs to be considered. So talk about some of those findings and what we concluded in our draft report. Again, we looked countywide terms of growth potential. And it's interesting, the Office of Financial Management, they do a pretty good job at forecasting, but they have such a wide range of forecasts. Their low forecast has negative growth for the next 20 years. Their medium forecast is essentially flat for 20 years. And their high-end forecast is basically what we're showing here. So, I think the high end, as being a planner, you always want to aim a little bit above the target, so you might hit the target. So this to me is the what would probably be the high end based on their models before COVID. Who knows what's going to happen now? It could induce more demand in places like White Salmon and certainly Western Klickitat County as people move out of metro areas to look for a lower density lifestyle. I hear that might be happening. It's supposed to be a pretty big bump next year in terms of housing starts. So who knows what will happen. But in looking at your forecast, we found that Well, Clickitat County could add, plan to add about 2,259 dwellings over the next 20 to 30 years. White Salmon, Bingen, Husum, and Lyle are probably the most marketable portions today of Clickitat County. And so that area is likely to capture over half of the demand. And White Salmon, Bingen combined are probably most marketable portions of Western Clickitat County based on what we've seen and heard and looked at the trends. So about 1,000 units over the next 20 to 30 years could reasonably be expected to be planned for in the White Salmon area, which includes the city, but also a portion of the urban exempt area around the city. And that can parlays into about 600 dwelling detached units, about 80 manufactured homes or cottage small units, and about 338 more attainable units through low density multifamily accessory dwellings or duplex, triplex developments. So pretty nice mix of housing. Again, still a little more on the low density side because that's consistent with the community's development pattern and kind of the rural kind of urban nature of the community seems to fit best. As we consider housing by price point, what we found is that it's going to be a pretty wide mix of housing to fully meet all the household demand preferences. Large lot single family is likely to require about 5 to 10% of the demand. Some of that could be second homes. Second homes are probably going to account for about 15 to 18% of the overall demand. We think, again, you could probably clamp down on second home development to some degree if it gets out of control, like some cities have, and keep that closer to the 15% range. Or you could not restrict it to long-term renters, and that could jump up to 20, 25% of the demand. So it's kind of in your court how the second home market plays out in White Salmon. Standard lot single family units, those now cost about $550,000 or more. So, you know, that's probably double what the home cost was about 10, 20 years ago when we last looked at this. So it's really gone way up for the standard single family detached housing product. To get into a more attainable price point, the small lot single family detached homes are becoming something we're starting to see as you get closer to urban areas. I don't know if you've seen it there as much yet, but these tend to be like 5,000 to 8,000 foot lots. And there's a big market appeal because you basically need attainable or household income about 90,000 to buy these homes. And so most working families can afford those if they have two wage earners in the household. Townhomes and plexes are another alternative product to get the price point down to about $350,000 or so. And that's about 8 to 12 units per acre. It could be less for duplexes, but that gets the price down to about $350,000 and it becomes attainable to households earning about $80,000 for that product. The rental products, primarily multifamily and accessory dwelling units and maybe even cottage dwellings, they tend to be kind of not fee simple. So you're basically renting or you're owning your unit within an HOA. That gets the price down to about $1,750 to $2,700 per month for renters. for apartments, and even less for accessory dwellings. That's about 15 to 25% of the market now. You have a lot of service workers in the Gorge area, and Hood River's, you know, becoming a lot less attainable than the White Salmon Bingen area. So there's pretty big demand for this segment. And about 60,000, 40 to 60,000 income level is what you need to afford to rent at 30% of your income going to rent for these units. So, you know, there's other products out there. There's manufactured home parks, which could be considered separately. That could be part of the, I think, the accessory dwelling cottage category. But cottages seem to be preferred if planners have their way. So that's kind of a demand profile.
I've got a question. What do you think about, or where can ADUs fit into this? Because an ADU is something that could easily be built. A lot of these other things are difficult, especially multifamily buildings, which haven't been put in at all for the last, who knows how long, 10 years.
It's such a great question. And it, you know, again, I can't compare you much to Portland, but in Portland, 10% of the housing added last year were in ADUs. And they didn't have ADUs like 15, 20 years ago, at least not much of a demand category, less than 1% probably.
But Todd, you bring up a good point, and I'm not totally up to speed with Portland, but if I recall, they did some pretty aggressive changes to the requirements for an ADU, making it paving a easier, less expensive path. Is that correct?
That's right. They eliminated system development charges or impact fees, which really lowered the cost of the entry. And they reduced setbacks, reduced parking requirements, things of that sort. And it did make a difference. Now, we've had this conversation in Stevenson recently, and Skamania County, and they're also interested in trying to make it a little easier to build ADUs in both Stevenson and throughout the county. Time will tell. They're not going to be like Portland, you know, they're not going to get 10%, but I think you can reduce some setback requirements and parking requirements and things of that sort. And if you're going to hook into the main house water meter or sewage disposal line, that might reduce some of the impact fees in your community as well.
Well, you could have the impact fees or get rid of them completely. Also remember that Portland's a completely different environment. There's much more demand and there's much less land. So they're gonna get more of them if you make them possible. And in Portland, parking was important. Here, there's still enough land possibly to accommodate off-street parking in a lot of places, mm-hmm. a lot more so than Portland. Yeah. So we don't have to completely base our plan on a Portland design.
I'm with you. I don't think ADUs work in every environment, but you know, long term, it's a nice way for homeowners to bring in some extra income. And there are even companies, at least in the Portland area, that will design, build, and construct and operate your ADU, and you just get a percentage of the income. I know those types of builders aren't there in the Gorge yet, but it could be a sign of the times.
Yeah, it's a coming thing, and we ought to be aware of it, that's all.
Aren't those builders, Todd, usually short-term renting those places?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, so that's another story. It's not providing dwelling units for the service people.
But we don't need to do that. And it's very easy to long-term rent an ADU. I've done it myself. It's easier. You don't have to have somebody managing it yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
One thing that I would like to make note of is, you know, on that bottom accessory dwelling and cottages, you know, we have a cottage example that gets used quite a bit and also doesn't fall within these 1,000, 1,500 a month income or rent. And that would be Wire's End. And so I just want to, as we talk about that, I think it also has to be, you know, it has to be understood or at least recognized that those were built out in a higher end, to a higher end level that triggered a higher cost. So I think that we just need to be mindful of when we hear cottages that we don't necessarily have to think of Wire's End as the example.
So Ross,
that might be fee simple, small lot cottages.
Yes.
So just as a FYI on Wire's End, the cottage zoning code was actually, you know, developed and adopted prior to Wire's End going in. At the desire of the developers who were getting ready to do Wire's End. Wire's End was not developed using that code. So just as an FYI, that's why you ended up with that creature. I'll just say
did
that.
Did they get concessions, Jan, on
yes,
that?
Yes, they did.
I remember the process. The code came in fairly quickly, early, not too far before Wire's End.
Right. They wanted to build Wire's End, and they came forward initially, and Tom, you probably remember this, with a kind of a very specific cottage-type development, which Chapin does do. The city council thought, yeah, that's great. Let's adopt this cottage zoning code, which they did. But then when they actually came in and submitted their plans, it was not under the cottage code. It was, I think, under a short plat code. And like a number of developments in those days, there were quite a bit of variances given to get that development in.
Yeah. So we just have to, like Ross was mentioning, we don't want Wire's End to be the standard bearer of the cottage code.
That's correct.
Right. And cottages nowadays, you know, I mean, they do clustered cottage developments on common land as a, you know, could be a PUD, or you could have a code that actually allows that to happen, you know, through design standards and like a zoning category to make it easier. And so that, you know, those are things that we're going to get to recommendations for you to consider as we move through this. But overall, you know, you have 60% demand being detached, kind of like what you see mostly in White Salmon today. But then you have 30 to 40% in these new housing products, which your code needs to maybe evolve a little bit to accommodate. And so that's kind of the bottom line there. Let's see here. So in terms of housing capacity, you have about 38 acres in RL zone, which I think, you know, is pretty much one unit per acre. Now we did assume two in our work because we were thinking, well, maybe people will add an ADU. Or, you know, maybe they'll ask for a, you know, a zone change before they develop that land. But, you know, these are rough numbers. And, you know, we're happy to fine tune this. Tom, I saw your comment about maximum being about 1.5 units per acre in the RL zone. Maybe we're happy to make that change.
You know? Well, I think, or well, I know that because I've
know what's going on in the county. And I just talked to Lori down there at the Click Attack in Goldendale. Like I said in my note to you, I'm glad you read it. There's a 2,000 square foot build zone in there. Minimum lot size. That's two lots per acre.
Mm-hmm.
If it's all that, you get more than 1.5.
Okay.
So, and then there's probably some one acre lot sizes. I don't know. I'd have to look at what makes up your number, your gross number of acres.
So Todd, this slide, correct me if I'm wrong, Todd, is just within the city limits. It doesn't include the urban area.
Correct.
So within our city limits, Tom, RRL is 20,000 acres or 20,000 square feet or greater. The 20,000 square feet is the minimum that you could have in RL. So if you had vacant land and you were able to, depending on slope and everything, then you would get two houses per acre.
Yes. And so I put 1.5. I think that's conservative. And, you know, you can do a PUD also if you have a lot of land.
Right. And you would be able to get more.
You could have variations of density.
That's correct.
So let's not be too low on their numbers, okay? It's the only point I'm making.
That's fine. But then, you know, again, but this assumes 100% build out too, which is very unlikely, you know.
Well, I agree with that completely. When we, in a minute, if we want to go back, I want to talk about something.
Okay.
That brings this up.
Okay. So, you know, excluding the redevelopable land where we identified 11.8 acres where basically the land value is greater than the improvement value, according to the assessor. So we call that out as redevelopable. But excluding that, if you build all up vacant and part vacant land out at these average densities, we got about 479 dwelling units in the city limits. And let's see, next we talk a little bit about the land need for housing. So based on our forecast of 1,010 units, the projected land need for kind of single family detached, it's going to be about 150 acres. You have about 87 acres in the city. So we're going to need about 63 additional acres. For the medium density categories, we have about 32 acres of net need. Again, these are net. This doesn't include the slopes. It doesn't include any constraints, which you have to add in to this. You have about 19 acres of vacant land in the city, assuming it all built out. So about 13 acres of additional need for that category, or a total of about 76 acres of additional need, rounded to 80 net buildable acres of need. Over and above what you have in your city today over the next 20 plus years to plan for. These are net acres. As I mentioned, you're in a very topographically challenged community. So it could be double that in terms of the amount of land that you actually do annex over time. So on the employment side, it's a slightly lower bar to jump over. We're forecasting a change in jobs, not much in retail. As you know, retail is evolving. A lot of people buying things online these days. Retail is driven a lot by household buying power. As you add more households, the retail comes after that point in time. So it's more down the road. But you know, the existing businesses have the potential to serve more demand just by adding more employees. And so retail's kind of the low forecast in our long-term look in terms of job types. Most of the job growth is in services, professional business services, some industrial job growth as existing businesses continue to expand. We're hopeful about that. And it's a big range from about 391 to 813 jobs over the next 20 to 30 years in the White Salmon Bingen area. Bingen is probably more positioned to capture some of the industrial jobs than White Salmon is, but White Salmon could capture probably more of the retail and service jobs. You know, so the actual land need for White Salmon and Bingen is only about 18 to 41 acres of employment lands. So mostly in Bingen, that'll be captured. Some limited development of White Salmon, some redevelopment opportunities, and some infill. So not a big change for employment.
Say, Todd, this is Tom. I just thought of this, and it's appropriate, I think, to think about what's going to happen with service personnel and them with work at home and what's happening at COVID and there's a big change. My daughter works from home all the time. She's in computer. Mm-hmm. She's a computer programmer, and yep. That could change the amount of buildings that people need.
Yeah. So we've tried to take that into account with this refill factor, which we're assuming that, you know, refill is basically adding jobs in existing vacant or underutilized space, including home-based workers. So, you know, we've assumed that this ranges from 10% to 50% of the jobs. And you know, it's anybody's guess, but I agree, there'll be a lot more telecommuting. There'll be more, you know, maybe there used to be job sharing, you know, going on, but now people want social distance in the job shared space. So home-based workforce, probably gonna be 10 to 50% of the total jobs.
But that could, you know, as you go back to our housing needs and demands and forecasts, depending on how this plays out and how long-term, you know, it is for people working at home, this could, in our area, given the proximity to an international airport and the desirable place to live, could really impact our demand.
Yeah.
We'll
speculate all we want, but I do think, I mean, I'm already hearing it where I am right now. I'm in Southern California visiting my daughter, and people are talking about moving down here from big cities like Minneapolis because they want to get out of the big city.
So Todd, in the heyday of the windsurfing, that happened a lot here. People moved here mainly for windsurfing, and then they telecommuted. And so we saw a lot of that happen here. Tom probably knows that. And people moved here just because they wanted to live, you know, they came and windsurfed here and they wanted mm-hmm. to continue windsurfing and they just loved it. And so they may have a job in LA, but they were working here. That kind of died down a little bit, I think, as telecommuting is a sort of a roller coaster. It's popular, it's not popular, it's popular, mm-hmm. it's not popular. But we certainly saw a lot of that in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, I'm partially guilty for moving to Oregon for the windsurfing.
the way I see it, a lot of windsurfers moved up into the, okay, now I've got to make a living. What am I going to do? Mm-hmm. And they found, may have found something to do.
Yeah. Well, the other thing driving it too is a water scarcity down here, and not only California, but Nevada and Arizona, even Texas, is becoming a real deal thing. And, you know, I hate to think about what would happen if, you know, 1% of these people try to migrate to the Northwest. Be a big deal.
And if I might just tag on to Michael's good statement, I mean, essentially, some of those folks grew big tech jobs and companies out of barns that wanted to be up here because of quality of life. So It's been an impact, but certainly some of that migration in brought good jobs and business growth. You could talk about the other side of the coin, but it's been, it'll continue to be an attractive place. And it's interesting to think about kind of the value of rural living near urban areas in the kind of the post-COVID kind of flight mentality. So it'll be an interesting dynamic.
Yeah. So in situ as they grow, you know, hopefully they'll continue to grow and spin off companies and support, you know, other engineering and supply chains. You know, you are, again, well positioned for that type of growth. And that's, you know, can't bank on it, but that's likely to occur. So Scott, you know, as we reconcile the supply with the demand, I'll kind of ask Scott to kind of run through this list of policy ideas or considerations. Some of these are not new to you. You've been talking about them already, but some of these came through some of the stakeholder interviews and input focus groups we received as well.
Well, I think you're right. Todd and Jan will recognize some of these, and some you'll see even in the 2009 study we were involved with. The idea here is that if about half of your housing need can be accommodated in the first 10 years within the city, and about half requires some larger investments in annexation, urban expanding, including the infrastructure we spoke of into the outside the city limits, then it might make some sense under an urbanization kind of approach where you say, you know, is this sort of nesting doll, I just call it nesting doll or inclusive zoning, is eroding some of the R3 or R2 capacity. Do we want to limit single family detached housing and keep it properly zoned for? That's one housing consideration. And I don't know that the urban idea of minimum density standards for R2 and R3 would make sense here. But what we're talking about is maximizing the ability for friendly density to match zoning in a way that doesn't overwhelm the vision for the community. So we really have to find the right fit for you, but we could provide more housing within those multifamily zones if we did either minimum density or less single family detached housing in those zones. So those are kind of the first two points. You have been dealing with ADUs and you have experience with the cottage development. Many of these are conditional uses. So in short, you know, would it make some sense with some code work to allow these sorts of developments outright? And how would you balance that with your desire for control for good quality as you expand the housing options? Modifying development standards is a way that you can address housing infill. We talked about a couple of those, ADUs, dropping conditional uses. Maybe you avoid that kind of continuum of variances by relaxing, you know, some of the, say, setbacks or density or lot coverage standards. And perhaps as you look at incentivizing, say, the right types of developments through the RPUD standard, if you're getting at affordable housing, you know, Can you modify or reward the types of housing development that you'd like to see by allowing folks to gain some density, say, for affordable housing is another idea. The idea of hanging more housing units on the core of the infrastructure goes back to the 2009 plan. It's very hard to deny that. If you can get more housing near the hospital and downtown, those are going to take advantage of the existing larger street system, the existing water and sewer capacity. So on a housing unit per mile of sewer line, for example, you are going to have a more affordable product to plug in than if you were to extend out into the non-city limits or urban exempt area, because the infrastructure is there and because the density is greater than with the rural housing. So that's just a thumbnail of some of the ideas. I think, you know, just sort of going back to what is it folks said, folks, you know, that were in this sort of stakeholder group, and you guys got about half in the west end of the 13 individual stakeholders and 6 focus groups. They did talk about diversity in the housing stock, filling gaps for infrastructure, being able to, you know, limit sort of commercial, that you have limited commercial and industrial land and whatnot. So all of those themes are kind of baked in. The urban area policy recommendations would have you looking towards that, you know, within the next 5 years, and certainly have some development ready within 10, should that high end or growth forecast come true, is have support for future annexation and housing developments, have in place the intergovernmental agreement with the county that says, this is how we handle land development. We're agreeing to what the city reviews, what the county reviews, what policy, what road standard, how we get the substantive portions of the city's plan and code actually in place in annexations, although maybe the county has some review or comment or IGA role in that development in the transition. So there's a few ways to make that work, but that's again coming all the way back a number of years. In terms of actually getting the work done, you know, we do a lot of sub-area planning. It's really about understanding the benefit and cost and understanding the public facility master plans so that you have orderly growth, so that you have something that you can say of, you know, alternative A, B, and C, you know, this is the area directly to the northeast, say, of the city that makes the most sense for growth. And this is where we want to focus limited resources towards preparing for housing development. So there's the physical planning, there's the facility master planning, all kind of rolled up to meet the best, best benefit for the cost. And another way to help property owners, because Jen aptly pointed out, you don't have a GMA city. So property owners could really benefit if you could advance a programmatic SEPA checklist so that everyone coming in for 1, 2, 4, 10 units isn't faced with an individual SEPA, that you've done a programmatic one for a sub area. Let's just say it's 80 acres, as Todd has indicated. And we say, okay, for that 80 acres, here's the plan. Here are the general impacts. Here's the wetland mitigation. In a general sense, here's what we've looked at for cultural. And this, you know, so, you know, we've looked at slopes. It doesn't mean that you don't have properties coming in having to go through the development review process, but they will be significantly streamlined with that sort of an investment. So those are some of the key policy recommendations that came out of the sort of need and capacity coupled with discussions with the city and stakeholder input.
Hey, Scott, thank you for that. One thing that caught my attention and kind of looking for some clarity, on the prior slide, you had a recommendation for minimum density standards for R2 and R3. R3, I get. R2, which this is Ross, I'll go on record, I live in. I'm curious if you could expand more. My interpretation of that is your minimum density is that anything in R2 has to be R2. Is that what you're saying there, or is there something else as it relates to density in that recommendation that I'm missing?
Well, I appreciate that question, because minimum density standards for R2 and R3 is somewhat of a mathematic sort of exercise that you don't just develop a full R1 lot on a property that could yield, you know, 3 dwelling units, for example, or a duplex. That's the policy trade-off for getting these zones to perform the way they're designed. But I'm also sensitive, and R2 is closer to the R1, and there are political decisions to make here. Do you mean for these R2 and R3 zones to yield those densities? Does that make sense? And if so, you know, is your zoning correct? Are some of these areas more rural? Certainly, it would do the city some good to reserve the R2 and R3 at minimum densities where they're near downtown or the hospital. So a big policy consideration, R2 is gonna be more sensitive than R3, Ross.
So, but going back to my clarity on minimum density, I mean, you could also construe that as, or that could also be interpreted as a size of lot for an R2, where you're lowering the lot size to incentivize more development. Is that what you're recommending, or is that how that would function?
I see your question. It's more about meeting the density that the zone is designed for, putting the duplex on the R2, than the actual lot size. However, having said that, you know, the lot size considerations could be part of that. If you're talking about the variety of housing types that we're speaking to, you know, and you have common wall and you have townhomes, certainly you want to make sure that you have the right density to get those 20, 25 foot townhomes in. So I'm going to say it could be both the minimum lot size and the number of units that could be yielded on the parent lot that we could consider.
Scott, this is Tom. I think that there is a difference between restricting single family housing on an R3 than worrying about minimum lot size on R2. Mainly because of how we have currently zoned R2. In that area south of Jewett, I believe the roads from 1st to 5th or something, all the way to Oak, is pretty much R2. That was historically small houses. There wasn't any R2 when I was younger. That now is R2, and I can see duplex townhomes being built there. I think you have a lot of people who live there in single family homes that probably want to maintain that. I think if you restrict being able to build a single family dwelling, you're making, let's say somebody wants to rebuild a house or rebuild a lot, and they take the house down. Does that mean you can't build another single family house in that area? I mean, remember, we've just taken over a bunch of single family houses.
I think
it's going to be a problem.
I think it's a really good point. Limit or disallow single family. It does say new. You're going to have some nonconformities when you do tighten codes down. But I mean, this is really the way this is written. There's a range of solutions, and you make some great points. It never really intends to zone somebody into a nonconformity, but for, you know, and usually you'll have replacement allowances, but for a new development, you know, maybe there's a provision where single family is encouraged in clusters, or maybe there's an ADU provision that also makes it acceptable in an RDU. I think there's a range here. I get at what you're saying, that we don't want to make a hard stop change in some of these areas because it'll be a hardship.
So there's a
good. So there's an open mind here, and it's not driven to just try to create density for density's sake.
Correct.
Tom and Scott, one of the ideas, and you know, this is just staff and the mayor, you know, as we kind of went through some of that housing moratorium exercises. And part of this actually came out because before it got halted, there was a rezone petition on the ground. And I think Erica got a couple of them, but I got quite a bit of comments from some people that live either in a currently zoned R2 and or an adjacent R1 neighborhood. And Tom and I have a long history of working on comp plans. And shortly after I left the Planning Commission after the new comp plan, there was quite the rezone from R1 to R2 throughout White Salmon, much to some people's dismay. And so there may be areas, don't know for sure, you'd have to like really, you know, I'd have to do more of an in-depth inventory. But there may be areas that are currently zoned R2 where there may be only like one duplex in the entire area. And the people that live there really don't want to be R2. They want to maintain their R1 neighborhood. They don't want duplexes coming in. And people that are in the R1 neighborhood that are adjacent to those neighborhoods have concerns. And those R1 neighborhoods really don't want accessory dwelling units. They're like, we live in an R1 neighborhood for a reason. We want our single family box, and we don't want tons of where you can't park on a street because there's not enough off-street parking. I mean, these were a number of the comments that we received via phone, or just, you know, when we were, you know, starting the process for a rezone from R1 to R2. And so I think, again, when we were looking at the housing issues under our housing moratorium, I think even the mayor recognized that R1 is a very traditional R1, and how you deal with that, where it's just single family houses. There's no accessory dwelling units. It's just a single family neighborhood. That there may be a need and a desire for that in certain locations. And there are very traditional neighborhoods in White Salmon that I would say are probably 95 to 98% single family dwellings. They're on small lots, 5,000 square feet, maybe 6,000 at the most. And so a lot of the people that live in those neighborhoods want to maintain that kind of a feel. So I think that's something, you know, the Planning Commission and the City Council, as they move through the comprehensive plan update, are going to have to wrestle with that tension.
I think that's
I agree with you, Jan.
And maybe, you know, just to interject, maybe what you find is, to match the vision with the current supply and tweak the zoning, that you do perhaps a little less than the aggressive, maybe even a moderate, to kind of ease in of some close-in density that makes sense where the neighborhoods can accept it. And you do push further out into the urban exempt area with more investment and more acreage. Just kind of looking at this from the broader perspective of where's the infrastructure, where is it most affordable now, then you do have to deal with the vision, the neighborhoods, and the policies to find the right mix.
And isn't our hospital district area currently, Erica, isn't that zoned R3, a big chunk of it?
It is, yes.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good thing. And I don't know if some of that has happened since 2009, but this could easily just say, provide some density near your employment density.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know from the council members' perspective, a little bit of this has been discussed about, like, you know, where could short-term rentals be located better? You know, closer to the core downtown area might make sense. Those accessory dwelling units closer to the downtown area might make sense if you're going to allow them to be used for short-term rentals, because that's where the restaurants are. That's where people want to go. That's where the city park is. That's where people are congregating, maybe in the future, if we get past the pandemic.
Can I just clarify, Erica, do we have some like the Jewett Creek side and the Poole Yard side? Are there some infill sites where you could put some more density? Is this hospital district comment about upzoning misplaced altogether from 2009 to present?
No,
So the properties around talking about Ingram Place and Eagle Ridge Drive, those were all developed here recently, lots developed and or vacant, ready for development. Same with the apartments, Ryan Village, there's a local church just behind a hospital as well that's all zoned R3. So that's the area that we're looking at. Additionally, I think the property you're talking about is further north, northeast, Dry Creek property, and that's RL zoned.
So Scott, there are a couple of areas, and Tom, you and I've chatted about one of them, but there is some land, not the land that Eric is talking about that's currently under proposal, but there is some larger vacant lands that have been talked about, either planned unit developments, a mixture of multifamily, duplexes, co-op, you know, so all kinds of different ideas. And then, of course, there's the land, Tom, out by Hunts Acres.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think there is land. It may not be like right core downtown, but I do think we have had people in that area that I think you're thinking of, Scott, that are interested in more than just single family, standard, detached home sites.
And I think some of this language, I'm thinking of shades of gray as we talk about it and looking at the language, you know, we're not just going to want to rezone everything in these districts, R3. It's gonna require a careful look.
Yes.
Scott, it's Tom again. You know, if we have some vacant areas within the city of White Salmon, and it makes sense from the lay of the land and from the utility aspect and the especially traffic, if we could do some rezoning to R2 and R3 that would encourage development and make the owner, landowner, more valuable, some money, you know, that makes sense for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a case for both. I mean, we're talking about 60% single family citywide. So you've got to do the 60-40. And it just gets more expensive if you spread that 40% out too far. So it doesn't mean we're not going to have great neighborhoods and pockets of R1 pre-existing. And it doesn't mean we're not going to have some new PUDs and R1s in areas right in town. But you do want to look at where it makes sense, just as Tom said, to rezone or to ensure that you're encouraging through incentives or disincentives like minimal density standards.
Yeah, well, if you rezone these vacant parcels, that's fine too. You're not affecting. My concern is where the R1 and the R2 mix. Gotcha. And Jan was explaining it very well when she said that R2 was expanded into the R1 district after that earlier comp plan.
Yeah, we have to be careful with that area. And I think, you know, this idea of mix and no wholesale, you know, just rezoning like that is consistent at the policy level, at the vision level, with the work we're building on. So I don't want any of this to be interpreted as sort of wholesale change, but I think we definitely want to consider policy recommendations that will encourage the types of housing that we've covered tonight.
And so, Scott, one thing I think that might be and I don't know how you would word it or put it in here, but I think it might be helpful, is there is a very high desire to maintain any current mobile home designation and to see those properties used for those purposes.
I'm just going to say
at that income level, I'm just going to be, you know, it is what it is. You know, they're lower cost rental opportunities. Let's just say that. So I think having that in here or some language in here, because that is an alternative. You mentioned that, I think, Todd, you mentioned that early on about manufactured home parks. And we have that designation. We're currently in the process of updating that zoning code, which we would hope would go forward and that those that desire would be reflected in the comp plan. So I think having some language in here about recognizing manufactured home parks and the opportunities that they afford for another housing opportunity.
Wouldn't it be good to put it as just maintaining the density level? There are a lot of units down there.
Well, I think the goal is to make sure that manufactured home parks are maintained, because as we spoke to Wires End, you could maintain the density level down there and have housing that's $2,000 a month, depending on what was built.
Yeah, you're gonna have to talk about it more strictly then. But you know, you can create
a code. I believe does.
If you create a new mobile home park where the old one is,
right,
you're changing that as far as affordability as well, because it has to be built at new recommendations.
Right, and the city and administration recognizes that, Tom.
Yeah. I'm just saying that you don't want it to become R1. That's all I'm saying.
R1 or R2.
Yeah.
And I think, Todd, you would agree that such a policy would fit to, you know, promote housing diversity and affordability under the findings.
Right. And I Tom's right. I think under the proposed amendments to the mobile home zoning is that it could, I think, under certain requirements, it could be converted to R3.
Gotcha.
But under certain requirements.
So that kind of,
if you made an R3 with cheap housing, what's wrong with that?
Well, that's what I think. I think that's what some of the requirements are, Tom.
Good.
Yeah. It's been a while since you guys looked at that code.
And here we're trying to get the kind of the right policy envelope so that you could go down to the code level to implement. So that's a good add. So those are any other sort of policy ideas? I think that's the wrap slide to questions, and we're at 7. Not sure how long you want to go, but Todd and I are here for you.
Say, I'd like to mention something I'd like you guys to mull over and see if I am thinking the right way. There is an exhibit that you showed that shows the amount of dwelling units that are going to go into White Salmon, Bingen, Husum, and Trout Lake and Lyle. I think those are the group. That's the grouping. Can you pull that one back up? It's about 5 back.
Yep. Hang on.
No, that's not it.
It's slide number 9.
There we go.
That is it, yes. Okay. I am more of a demand person in terms of looking at where people are going to go than supply. Just because there is land in white salmon of a certain type doesn't mean that it's going to get filled. But there will be a certain demand of housing that's needed. May not be this much, okay? I'm not gonna buy into that completely, but there is gonna be a demand. You've made an estimation as how much is going to go in each area right here. We have history of building permits for the last 7 years that I'm aware of. I'm also aware of development outside of this the greater white salmon, in other words, Houston. I think that we don't need to say this is exactly what the percentages that are going to go everywhere. I think that when white salmon doesn't have land available, or the right kind of land, or the right kind of price, or it might have another moratorium, that's going to affect where people build. I've seen it happen. I also know that there are 50 small houses that have been agreed by the county to be developed on the Houston Hills Golf Course. And they're going to be low income. That's 50. You have 69 in Houston and Trout Lake in 20 or 30 years.
So, Tom, what will be interesting is we actually had one of the developers testify before the city council. I think it was related to the housing moratorium.
Yeah, well, it's that lady. It's the lady, the young lady and the guy. They've recently sold it. It's in limbo, okay? It's not going to happen right away.
Right.
But the point I'm making,
I think
it doesn't have to happen,
forecast.
But it's been done. And it could happen and something like that is going to happen in 25 years, okay? And what my thrust of this whole thing is, all of the housing doesn't have to hit white salmon. There's going to be a certain amount of demand, okay? And not everybody's going to get into white salmon, especially when you start filling up the land. Some of that land might never be for sale, okay? So in other words, I call it seepage. We're going to have more development 30 years from now in Houston, in Snowden, because of a bunch of reasons. And one of them is there's free land, lots more land, and it's going to be less expensive. And just follow the history of any, I mean, I've spent a fair amount of time early in my life in Aspen, Colorado. I've spent in Sun Valley. I've seen these places develop. And I know kind of what happens. And we're not going to be any real difference. And no matter how we plan or what we do. So we shouldn't be scared of these numbers, and it's going to start looking better in the end. I guess.
I mean, I guess.
That's kind of what I want to say. Okay.
That's fine. You know, it's gone out in 20 years, and, you know, you're going to have to revisit this in about 10 anyway and see where you go. But I know the county was, a little bit shell-shocked from trying to change zoning or to induce development out in Houston in the past. And so they're being very conservative about what's likely to happen in the future.
Well, are you familiar with this 50 lots Houston Hills Golf Course development plan?
I
that's the first phase?
Yeah.
Anyway, there's lots that if they ever became online, It'd take some of this demand, okay?
I don't know, also, I guess a question is, did you guys, as far as Bingen's concerned, which I know is outside of the scope of White Sand, but the Dickey Farms development in the housing stock that is projected to go in there? I'm curious. Maybe.
So Ross, I'm a little bit familiar with that because I still talk to Betty a lot. So, yeah. You know, and Tom will agree with me on this. We hear a lot of these developments, right? You hear about them. People may even apply for them. I know large companies that apply for projects and they don't happen. Tom knows what I'm talking about. And so
in 30 years, they might.
Right. At some point, maybe they will.
Oh, they will, for sure.
But the reality is, until you see the shovel around here, my experience has been, until you see the shovel hit the dirt, those projects are just in the air. I mean, I have worked with this stuff for over 30 years, and I've seen projects, the Dry Creek project. There's been a project on that piece of property every 10 years. If this one actually happens, it'll be a miracle. You know, the Hewsome Hills golf course thing. I think a lot of people thought that was fairly aggressive. And were those small lots going to draw the people for, you know, out there? Dickey Farms, I would certainly hope something could happen there. That is zoned both commercial and multifamily, commercial up front and multifamily towards the back of the hill. That property has not sold. That project has not closed. And so maybe it'll happen. I think what Todd is saying, this is a forecast based on a whole lot of different factors. Looking at population growth, I'm sure they looked at some of the building statistics. And it at this time, it's the best, you know, based on historical and population growth. And Tom's right, things can change. You know, that Dickey Farms project could sell this summer, and next summer they're building on it, and this whole chart would change.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't even have to be this summer, Jan. It could be 10 years from now.
Right.
It still affects the amount of land and units that can be built around here. And although you have 189 in Bingen.
Right, but this is just a forecast over 20 to 30 years. And as Todd was saying, you know, typically when you review these urbanization studies every, you know, 10 years or 6 to 10 years, typically when you're doing a comprehensive plan update, you review this data. And it's changing. It's not cast in stone. It's fluid. And this is, at this time, kind of a picture without second guessing a whole bunch of other stuff of what could take place. Like, what is the current best guesstimate of what the market forecast is over 20 to 30 years, knowing that 5 years from now, this picture could be totally wrong.
Well, you know, we can see what was forecasted in the 2009 urbanization study. We can see where we are in 2020 because it was forecast, and now we know.
Right.
And if you look at the population that was forecast, it's illuminating.
Right. And
check,
I think
check that one out. Okay. Now, and I'm not, there's no blame. It's just the way it is. Okay. And I think we've done well. I think we have we're facing growth. It's just how much and where is it going to go?
And that's what you have to use this information that's in the study as you start working through your comprehensive goals and policies you use that information to make those determinations. This really is information, and as you saw at the very end, some very broad policy recommendations. And then you take that information, and then you actually create your goals and policies in your comp plan under the housing section or employment section or, you know, commercial section.
So, well, I think we have some good goals, Scott. I like those.
Good. Yeah, we've got progress on the comp plan. So this is, as Jan said, there's a forecast. Todd could tell you more about it, but he has to divvy out the likely demand per area in order to make the supply and demand findings, and then those relate to the policy. So this is a great starting point. It's draft. I don't know what more we're looking for on this one, Todd and Jan, for now. Is it a two-week comment period to move towards wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, that would be ideal. We want to keep it moving. And I'll just add too, I mean, we do have to look at past trends in actual building permits by location, and you know, that helps guide us a little bit on the forecast side. But also, you know, we're not assuming infrastructure is a constraint either in this forecast. So if white salmon has the ability to accommodate, you know, with water and sewer and zoning, this amount of development, we feel confident that you will get it, you know.
If the zoning codes allowed it.
Yeah.
And so how does the sewer treatment plant handle this amount of people?
Well, that's the next step. They're going to have to update some of their long range plans to make sure they have the capacity, make sure the rates, you know, can handle the growth. Maybe, you know, take all that into consideration. That would be the next step. But I think the planning kind of drives that to some degree too.
So that's what this document, Tom, helps with this. And then also, you know, the comprehensive plan goals and policies, which will then guide your zoning. And so you take this urbanization study and buildable lands inventory, and you use it as a tool. It is not the wherewithal or the end all of what you're doing. It's really a guiding document. And these very well done slideshow is just a summary of what's actually in the document. I recommend that everyone read it. It does talk about where they got these numbers. I made some substantial comments about population and some numbers that I thought were incorrect initially. I work with those numbers all the time. So my recommendation is for the Planning Commission to read the urbanization study and to get comments back to Erica, CC me on them by 2 weeks from now would be the 24th. And then we can get those, look at those and figure out does it need an amendment or is it just a comment back to a planning commissioner about, clarification. And then FCS can finalize their product for the city of White Salmon. And then I believe they have other stuff they need to be doing for the county. The county graciously allowed FCS to prioritize the White Salmon area of the contract because we asked for that because of the comprehensive plan. So that would then, you know, FCS can finalize the urbanization study, and then it becomes one of many tools that you guys will use during your comprehensive plan update process. Scott will take it and he'll help you use it. And it'll be a tool used for a lot of things, annexations in the future. It's one of many tools that the city will have available to them as they make land use decisions in the future. The other thing I just want to comment on is staff will be working with Scott, we'll be revising, you know, kind of where we're at with the comprehensive plan update process. We will be continuing teleconferencing, but we will be working out opportunities for public comment in the future, Ross. So there's been some changes. The city council is going to talk a little bit about that next week. Planning commissions, I think, you know, are going to continue meetings twice a month, unless for some reason there just needs to be a longer gap because Scott's working on something. At the present time, the housing moratorium is continuing. It expires on July 15th. I do not believe it will be extended. That will be up to the council to make that decision. And they have to make that decision by their July 1st council meeting. So stay tuned. The Planning Commission is going to get busy. You guys are going to be busy seeing a lot of material, reading a lot of material, providing comments to staff and consultants. And we will be working out a way, particularly as consultants prepare information and it starts to get the time when you guys are really starting to move into looking at policies and goals and making sure that we get that public comment. So we anticipate, because of physical distancing requirements, that teleconferences will continue into the fall. Even into phase three, there's just no way in that council meeting room that you can put 6 feet between council members and staff. You would literally only be able to have a handful of the public there. And so, we're gonna be in this format for a while and possibly even into the winter time.
Hey, Jan.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little more hopeful than you are. Oregon is going into phase two. And in phase two in Oregon, I think you can have 50 people in a room. Now, I am not
with social proposing, distancing.
I am not, Jan, hold on a second. I am not proposing that you should have public meetings. But I would hope that our group could somehow sit 10 feet apart in a big U-shaped something at the meeting room. I do not know why couldn't.
Here's why, Tom, because these are public meetings. The public needs to be allowed to attend. So this process allows the board and the public, anyone who wants to attend. And so, yes, we could just put staff in there and members, but that doesn't allow the public to attend. We would
I'm trying to problem solve here.
I know you don't like this format.
I can't imagine why, if we can get six of us together, or eight or whatever, why you couldn't do a telecommuting, whatever it is, with the public and have all of us look at it together.
Well,
as a group.
There are some reasons. And
I'm going to do some research on this, okay?
Remember,
because I think it can happen.
Right. The city council will make that decision. And so,
yeah, but they can have some public input, if it is reasonable.
Tom, we are not Oregon. We do not go by Oregon's requirements. We go by Governor Inslee's requirements. And so at this time, he is not allowing in-person public meetings.
Yeah, I'm not saying you should, but it might happen is all I'm telling you.
Yes, I'm not saying it won't.
He can't hold out forever.
He can try. I'm not saying it won't, Tom. I'm just saying that it could be well into the fall before we have in-person meetings.
Anyway, I sure hope we can get going on. And it doesn't hurt to have somebody saying this, okay?
And And there are ways to allow public comment. The city council's doing that. You can, and there are ways to allow public hearings. And the city council.
Don't get me wrong. I thought this was a good meeting. Okay. Thank you, Todd, and thank you, Scott.
Okay. So, Ross.
Very welcome.
Thank you for your time.
And Michael, Erica, and Jan.
Yes. And Jan, what was Greg? You said, I didn't catch, you said you had emailed Greg. Should I reach out to him or will you reach out to him to find out?
Erica did. For some reason, and I have no idea why, because I have the correct email. And I don't know if he just uses his phone and it's not set up correctly on his phone, but he doesn't appear to be, he's gotten some city emails. And so, you know, he probably needs to update his Gmail information on his phone or tablet or whatever he's using. Because I've checked, I mean, I'm not using some odd Gmail. Erica's not using, you know, I mean, we're all using the right city email. And so, not for sure why he's not getting the emails, but it appears that he didn't for some reason. And so, of course, there's always a website. We encourage people to look at our website occasionally and keep updated with it.
Yeah, I would say from personal experience, the website provides me all the necessary information within my planning commission role.
That's where I got all my information out of it. Well done.
We're trying to keep it updated.
Do we have to do anything special to adjourn?
Just say that you're adjourned and I'll stop recording and end the meeting.
All right.
I move that we adjourn.
Okay. Bye.
I second that. Bye.
Thank you.